Okay. Well, just to keep on the light and easy side, how about this for a first question? Do you have a state of Massachusetts medical marijuana card?
No.
Okay. Do you have any favorite strains you would share with us?
No, I don't use ever.
Okay. So this is just an issue for
never,
you.
Never even occurred to me to get a medical marijuana card because I simply don't use. So.
Okay. What problems are unique to projecting about potential marijuana taxation?
Well, the crucial problem with figuring out how much tax revenue we'd get is we don't know the size of the market. And it's hard to determine the precise size of any economic market, but especially if it's underground. And, of course, you don't have the standard ways of measuring it from, say, retail sales and things like that. So people have used other methods, which provide some orders of magnitude, but they're subject to a lot more uncertainty.
Okay, well speaking of the methods, you have stayed over the course of the last decade, you have at least four or five reports that you've put out.
Mm-hmm.
Have you lost track yourself?
I've sort of lost track, partially because they're all sort of variations on the initial theme, so they're not so different from each other. Some have been just updates, some have just sort of expanded the, whether they looked at states versus federal and so on, but yes, something like four or five reports.
Okay, now your conclusions have been remarkably consistent over that last decade, as I know that you're aware.
Right.
The overarching question that I have is, as the marijuana issues keep getting more and more press, as TV and movies keep portraying more and more marijuana, there's an incredible amount of advertising and an incredible amount of publicity advertising the whole marijuana movement. Yet your survey seems to not take this as a factor whatsoever. So what am I missing?
Well, if we take data on use rates from any of the existing main surveys, there's basically two main sources. One is conducted by the federal government, the National Household Survey of Drug Use. And then there's something called Monitoring the Future, which is a survey of high school seniors conducted by the University of Michigan. So those give use rates for marijuana, you know, reported use rates. Of course, they may be inaccurate in some ways, but those don't show any dramatic changes up or down. They show some changes up or down, but it's not as though they say we went from a 10% use rate to a 50% use rate or anything like that. So I think a lot of the fluctuation of whether the movies portray it one way or the other is you know, changing trends, fads, and not a reflection of changes in the amount of underlying use. Or at least it's plausible that it doesn't bear much resemblance to the change in underlying use. Now, second, I've deliberately just sort of stayed with the main estimate of the amount of the size of the market that I took from a report commissioned by the White House Drug Czar's office back in the sort of late 1990s, published in 2001. And I've just taken that number and I've updated it for inflation. I've looked at whether maybe I should update a little based on use rates changes. And those have gone up a little bit in the official data, but not dramatically. And I want to use their number for two reasons, or maybe three. One, I read the study and it seemed sensible. It seemed like it made reasonable assumptions. Second, it's an order of magnitude that seems plausible to me in the sense of how big a market are they talking about compared to alcohol and tobacco? Their estimates around of the size of the marijuana market that imply it's way bigger than the legalized alcohol or tobacco markets, and that doesn't strike me as plausible. Okay? But third, I also wanted to use a number that was basically beyond criticism, okay, in particular beyond criticism from the White House Drug Czar Office or the DEA or other advocates of marijuana prohibition. Because I want to, and so that's why I use their number, because I don't want them to be able to say, you deliberately inflated the size of the market to make the tax revenue estimates look bigger than they're actually going to be. So I think given that I have, if anything, erred on the low side, I'm immune from that criticism.
But Jeff, how long is the shelf life of that one table you referred to from ONDCP in 2000? You've given it a decade-long shelf life. Is there any outer limit to its shelf life?
Well, if we sort of got data from the surveys suggesting that use rates amongst the overall population were not 10%, but were 20 or 25%, then absolutely that number would have outlived any usefulness. But we don't see that. We see fluctuations in use rates of a couple of percentage points or even less over long periods. It seems to be relatively stable, just as alcohol use rates, you know, are relatively stable. Tobacco use rates, of course, have come down dramatically over 50 or 60 years, but that's a somewhat different phenomenon. So until there's obviously some, you know, second answer would be until there's something better, I will probably continue to use that, and I continue to read other people's estimates and think about whether I should change my view. And they maybe nudge me that maybe I'm 20 or 50% too low, but they certainly don't convince me that I'm off by a factor of 10, which is how different some of the estimates out there are from the numbers.
You're talking about the undergraduate report by Max Chaikin from your IV?
That's sort of at the extreme end. That's like 20 times bigger than my number. Then there are reports from other researchers that are somewhere between sort of 5 and 10 times my number. And if you want, we can go into those details. But I think there are reasons to be very cautious about that order of magnitude.
Okay. Getting back to the advertising and publicity from an economic viewpoint, I'm just curious. I mean, obviously marijuana is a product that a lot of people want, correct?
Right.
Now, Budweiser is a really good beer, and a lot of people want it, and then they still advertise the heck out of it.
Right.
Coke is a really good soft drink. Everybody already wants it, and they still advertise the heck out of it.
Right.
Why do those commodities get incredible advertising? It seems like you're almost discounting advertising on the public's consumption.
Well, I think there's a couple things to say. One is that there is, in some sense, a lot of advertising already for marijuana. There's the movies and the TV shows and the books and all that that create, obviously, an awareness. And there's lots of ways people find out about products and realize they might have some beneficial or negative effects beyond advertising by the producer. There's just word of mouth. There's all the anti-drug education that goes on in junior high schools and high schools. So every single student who goes through the schools is made aware of the existence of marijuana. They may be dissuaded. They may, in fact, be sort of enticed by some of that sort of anti-drug education. But there's no scarcity of knowledge about the existence. Second, advertising is expensive. Budweiser spends a lot of money, okay, selling something which is, you know, not much more than water. Same thing. And they get people to spend a fair bit of money on something where the raw ingredients are not all that costly. That means they have to charge a high price because they're spending all that money on the advertising in addition to the amount they spend on the materials. So I think that advertising of a legalized marijuana would mean higher prices, and that tends to discourage consumption. That also is a factor that actually limits the market rather than enhances the market.
But right now, all that advertising and publicity is free. Normally, corporations that want that level of publicity and advertising would have to pay a fortune for it. Right now, it's just kind of naturally occurred. So to me, that's like almost a naturally occurring free boost. But once again, I can't put words into your mouth.
So if they're getting a free boost now, and if under – and indeed, if it became legal, then there were a sort of relatively small number of big suppliers of marijuana, you know, Miller, Budweiser, or Philip Morris versus R.J. Reynolds. Those sellers of a product like that, they would love for someone to ban advertising, because then they could save all that money on advertising. Okay? But as long as policy allows legal advertising, you're going to end up in kind of an arms race between rival suppliers of marijuana, where they're going to spend tons of money claiming their product is better than their rival's product. That means the prices will be higher, and that will limit the size of the market. So that's part of what I'm saying. I don't boom in this amount of marijuana consumed. I think that the price is going to not fall that much, and indeed in some ways could go up, because if you allow legal advertising of a legalized marijuana.
I would imagine it would both go down and up. There would be collectability, and then there'll be more commercial strains available, would be my guess.
And there will also be a broad range of product varieties. So just as there's more or less generic alcohol, there's, you know, it's got a brand name on it, but it's basically rot gut. It's not heavily advertised. And there are generic cigarettes. All those are low price. There will be relatively generic marijuana, but there will also be the Budweiser equivalent of marijuana, which will be way expensive relative to its raw ingredients. And most people seem to buy the branded stuff, okay, the advertised stuff, okay, and that's a factor limiting the size of the market, not necessarily enhancing it. The extent, of course, that advertising is successful at getting people to smoke marijuana, some of that may come from reduced consumption of alcohol, but that means that tax revenues for alcohol go down even while tax revenues for marijuana go up. That's another reason to be somewhat cautious about thinking we're going to get huge net increases in tax revenues from legalized marijuana.
Okay, now speaking of huge increases, you mentioned the tobacco industry. Mm-hmm. Why does your projection not include what big tobacco could make, what big pharma could make, what big food could make? Why does it seem like it's all based on individuals and not what corporations would kick in a legalization landscape?
My estimates do take account of all that. My estimates, given the size of the market that I estimate, okay, and the dispute across different researchers who've looked at the tax revenue issue, I think comes down almost entirely to how big the market will be, okay? Not to our assumptions about what the tax rate could be, not to our assumptions about how the price would adjust. It's what do you think the size of the market is, okay, now, and how, and that then feeds into how much it would change. But my estimates assume that there would be standard business taxes, employment taxes, income taxes, and all that, that we would, if there's a certain amount of revenue generated in a legalized marijuana market, I assume that we would collect a fraction of that is equal or indeed a bit higher than the fraction we collect from existing legalized industries. So 30% is sort of in round numbers, okay, is what the tax revenue is relative to economic activity, relative to GDP. And I assume that we'd have a special tax on marijuana, but I am taking account of all of those factors, okay, and I still think they don't add up to, you know, huge, huge numbers because it's one product, right? If we look at the tax revenue we get from any product, no matter how popular, it's maybe tens of billions, but it's not hundreds of billions.
Will marijuana ever appear on the International Commodities Exchange?
It should, but I don't know if it will. I can't make that kind of prediction.
If it was legal, do you think it would zoom to the top of the charts of the commodities?
No, I think that we are being a bit from the tax revenue perspective, hopeful that somehow this is a miracle commodity that's going to sort of overtake everything else. For example, you hear this statement all the time, that marijuana is the largest single cash crop in California.
Right.
I challenge anybody to discover the source of that statement, right? Because I've been hearing that statement for decades, okay? And I bet whoever made that statement had zero data to back it up.
Okay.
But even if it is, there are many, many, many cash crops in California. There are many crops. So, and whether it's cash or not is, of course, not the crucial issue. There's wheat and corn and soybeans and all that stuff. It just can't be that big a deal because it's only one of zillions of things that any economy produces.
Yeah, but is anybody starting avocado dispensaries?
But, look, there are, in effect, Advil dispensaries, aspirin dispensaries. Okay, yes, those bring in some tax revenue, but they're only one of zillions of pharmaceuticals. Marijuana would be one of many, many pharmaceutical products, if you think it that way. It would be one of many intoxicating products that's available along with alcohol, you know, if you want to think of it that way. So it's very easy to get excited and assume that it's going to be huge, but a lot of that is double counting, okay? For example, forgetting that the purchases on marijuana don't come from nowhere. They come from shifting purchases from something else. And so we're going to get less tax revenue from other sources.
Mm. Speaking of the pharmacy industry, why were they snoozing when the dispensary system was set up? Why didn't they get that for themselves?
Why didn't who get that for themselves?
The pharmacy industry.
Oh, I think that...
Since we're talking about something that you need a doctor's prescription for, they would seem to be a natural, but they must have been snoozing. How did they miss that opportunity?
I don't know. My guess is that they were betting that it's not going to become as big or as important as it seems it actually might turn out to be. And they don't want the idea of being associated with a quote-unquote illegal drug. And so they decided to stay away. A different explanation, of course, is they don't think there's actually all that much revenue available. And so it wasn't in their interest to go near it, given it has some negative PR aspects. Well, that would be consistent with my view that, yes, this is a source of some revenue, but not unbelievable gobs of revenue.
Okay. Well, towards the goal of trying to, within reason, find some more revenue, I'm curious why the term metric ton is absent from your reports, and it's so prevalent in Getman that I know you're familiar with, and Chasen, to name a few.
Oh, I mean, they sort of did the estimates just in a slightly different way. Because I started with a dollar figure estimated by the ONDCP's report. Now, that, in fact, had been built up from data on grams, ounces, tons, et cetera. Okay. I never needed to use the direct data directly on the physical number of units. So I just had an estimate of the size of the market measured in dollars, and then using sort of standard microeconomics about the responsiveness of demand for product as a function of the change in the price, could ask how much the market would change if the price went down and how much the revenue would be if there were a certain size market and you imposed a certain tax rate. So those metric ton numbers are implicit in the approach that I've used, but given the source that I was starting with, then I didn't need to talk about them any further.
Okay. Can we talk about sin taxes a little bit?
Sure.
The first question is there a difference between excise taxes and sin taxes?
Kind of depends mainly whether you think the commodity in question is something that's good or bad. Not really, no. An excise tax and a sin tax are, for economic purposes, the same thing. Some people prefer the term sin tax because they want to send the message that this activity should be discouraged, and other people object to it because they don't think that government should be taking a stand on what's sinful or not. No, the way I use them, they're the same thing.
Okay, so let me see if I have my numbers correctly. I believe in your earlier reports of about the year 2005, you mentioned a 59% sin tax rate, and your new 2010 report, you're talking about a 50% rate. Is that, am I correct?
I don't actually remember the 50%, but yes, I think I used a 50% in the most recent version of my reports.
Okay, do you think that, are there any surveys done to indicate whether that would be palatable to buyers and sellers?
I'm not aware of surveys, but we have experience with excise taxes of at least that rate on alcohol and tobacco. And what we observe is that when you get taxes of that level in different jurisdictions, okay, that don't necessarily next to jurisdictions at a much lower rate, say a high cigarette tax in one state and a very low cigarette tax in another state, you absolutely induce some cross-border shopping to avoid the high taxes. Mm-hmm. But if you're looking at the level of a country as a whole, it seems to be possible to have 50, 60, 80% sin tax rates without driving the market underground. That may be a bit surprising. Okay, you can certainly, there's certainly an incentive for the underground market to develop as that rate gets high. But it also seems to be that most people want to consume from a legal supplier, and therefore you can impose a reasonably high sin tax without driving the market underground. That's what that experience from alcohol and tobacco seems to suggest.
Because they have the variety is very attractive to be able to go into a dispensary and choose from different varieties, just like you go into a liquor store and you have 30 varieties of single malt scotch.
There's a plus from having varieties. There's a plus from knowing the reputation of the seller, so you're pretty sure that you're getting what you think you're getting, not something that may have been adulterated or watered down. There's the possibility of suing the manufacturer if it turns out it was, you know, not what it professed to be. If it injures you in some way, you don't have to necessarily go into a bad part of town. You're not buying it from people who are engaging in criminal activity. You're just going into a store, and people could grow their own tomatoes, okay, at much, much lower monetary expenditure, okay, than going to the grocery store. But ultimately, almost all are purchased from the grocery store, not from, you know, produced in backyards. So again, people, both for convenience and for the reliability of a regular, legal above-ground supplier, seem to be willing to pay some premium for that.
Okay, so but you are giving a personal opinion that that 50% or so would be palatable. There's no particular data to support that. Is that fair?
No, there are data. There's the evidence from other commodities, which economists think of data like that as being much more reliable than what people say in surveys. Okay? When people say, oh, this is what I would do in this hypothetical situation, that could be a very noisy indicator of what they will actually do in that situation, because they haven't really thought through exactly how they would feel and what the real trade-offs would be when confronted with that. If we see that governments have imposed 50, 60, 80% tax rates and not driven the market underground, that's pretty strong evidence on what the effect would be if we did that for some relatively similar commodity. So I think it's, my view is definitely based on data, but a different kind of data than surveys.
well, would it be a valid criticism that you're comparing marijuana, a drug with some quite a bit of therapeutic value, to tobacco and alcohol, which, I mean, I guess someone could argue that a glass or two of wine is good for the heart, but in general have much less evidence of any kind of palliative effects?
Well, first, I would state the point that you just made, that many people think in a somewhat informal way of alcohol, for example, as having a therapeutic value, not necessarily because it's preventing heart attack, but just it relaxes you and makes it easier for you to sort of enjoy a pleasant evening after a hard day at work and things like that. Second, for marijuana users, I think there's a broad range of the way in which people are using it therapeutically. In some cases, it's clearly very similar to the way people use prescription pharmaceuticals for a very specific condition with these sort of extreme sort of negative effects. In other cases, I think it is much more like the glass of wine or the martini at the end of the day. It's helpful for relaxation, for calming, for putting you in a better mood. And so I think the distinction is not so clear cut. In any case, I don't see why that would affect the nature of the calculation. The way economists think about it, at least, is what matters is your demand for a good. If your demand for a good is there, then you're going to want to purchase it. If it's more convenient to purchase it from a legal supplier, if you get more reliability from a legal supplier, then that's going to tend to make you willing to pay some sin tax in order to have that advantage. Now, of course, if it's right that this sin tax will keep some of the market underground, that's one more reason why we should think that the tax revenue we're going to collect is moderate, not huge. If a lot of the market goes under, stays underground, then of course we don't collect nearly as much in tax revenue, and I think that's another reason to be cautious.
Okay, I know that you're very, very cautious. I know that you're like a courageous crusader for legalization, but you have a little dichotomy going. But when you're talking
I don't think it's a dichotomy. I don't think it's a dichotomy.
You're easily the most conservative out there, so that's why I wanted to interview you, because it fascinates me.
But there's another side of it, which is whatever the amount is, whether the tax revenue for the country as a whole, say, is $10 billion or $50 billion or $500 billion, whatever number you want to assume for the moment, none of that should be the main reason to legalize marijuana. The crucial reason to legalize marijuana really should be, why not? Okay, why should the government be prohibiting something, okay, or harassing people, arresting people, jailing people for producing, selling, and consuming something, unless there's a compelling case that in doing any of those things, people are harming innocent third parties? Okay? That's the attitude toward alcohol, okay, that the country accepts, in my view, exactly the right attitude. So we certainly try to prevent people from using alcohol in ways that harm others, such as driving a car when you're under the influence. But we don't criminalize the whole industry. We don't make it illegal to produce it or sell it or consume it. We accept that the vast majority of people use alcohol in a way which is either maybe mildly beneficial, maybe somewhat beneficial if the heart effects are substantial, but in any case, for the most part, not harmful to themselves or others. And that's why it's a legal good, and we only go after the irresponsible use. That should be the attitude, and that's the reason to legalize marijuana, even if it didn't give us a single dollar of extra tax revenue or save us a single dollar of government expenditure. It should still be legal for basically reasons of freedom and liberty, okay, never mind any of these sort of economic arguments.
But
I don't want what I think are the compelling arguments, the liberty arguments, to end up being undercut, okay, by inflated, excessive, and possibly, you know, contaminated estimates of the economic benefits. I think that makes the movement seem somewhat disingenuous. Okay, we're trying to sell people on this as being kind of a free lunch. It's not a free lunch. Some people will misuse marijuana. Of course, most of them are already doing that. So I think the increase in the misuse of marijuana will be very small, but okay, we shouldn't think that somehow we're getting some great big goose that laid the golden egg, okay, benefit out of this. The benefit is letting people consume marijuana in peace.
With all that said, and I heard everything you said, and you're preaching to the choir, is there a magic number that could induce politicians to get a little bit off the fence? Is there a magic number that if you're a Republican from a red state, you can get past the Nancy Reagan programming that you had?
I think it depends on politics.
Everything has its price. Is there a magic number?
I have no idea if there's a magic number. I think it, you know, whether the number, whatever it is helps move politicians depends a lot on what area they represent. Okay, for some politicians who are relatively liberal, relatively sympathetic districts, of course, they don't really necessarily need a big number. Their constituents are with them already. For people who are in hardcore red states or red districts, I think, you know, there's lots of social conservatives who couldn't care less whether the number is 10 billion, 50 billion, 100 billion. They think it's evil, and they don't want to put a price on giving up their view that it's evil. There clearly are people, you know, politicians in the middle. There are districts that are sort of on the fence, that have more of a mix. And I certainly talk to lots of politicians who say, look, I need cover. I agree with you sort of philosophically or morally, whatever, but I need an excuse to tell my constituent that I'm going to vote for this. And so, yes, for some politicians, a big number maybe is helpful, but I don't think that's a reason to make the number bigger than my objective analysis of the economics suggests.
Well, that's pretty much what President Obama says, correct?
On which?
He basically says to make it legal, the reason to do it is not just to make the money from it.
But he hasn't said that he's in favor of making it legal.
No, but he said if it ever became legal, it wouldn't be just to raise the revenue.
I agree with that.
Okay.
I agree with
that. I understand. Do you think that the president or the Democrats in general are vulnerable to attacks from Republicans that take the, quote, higher ground? Would that be a good political strategy for them to take?
Wait, so I think that for the Democrats to take on this issue, you know, especially outside of California, is risky because they want people in the middle. If you think about independents broadly, they're a very mixed group. I mean, some independents are sort of libertarians who would be absolutely, you know, great with this issue, but many independents are, you know, pretty socially moderate, maybe socially conservative, but they're, even if they're not sort of hardcore religious right. So I think for a lot of Democrats in moderate state, you know, I don't know, the purple instead of red versus blue, they would feel very nervous about this issue. Now, they don't have to address it yet because for the moment it's basically a California issue, okay, with the legalization initiative that's on the ballot in November. But if I were a Democrat, I would just hope this issue would go away. You know, a Democrat from a moderate state, I would want this issue to go away because either way, I think I'm, you know, it's not great for me.
It seems to me it would be a great Republican strategy because what they do now is with their pro-life program, they get a lot of people to vote for them that the rest of their platform doesn't serve and vote for them on a single issue alone.
Right.
I mean, if I was them, I would think about if I came out totally in favor, how many people would vote for me on that single issue alone that wouldn't normally vote for me.
But what if all those people who were voting for you on your anti-abortion stance abandoned you? And what if you're from a district where that's a significant fraction of your support? And what if the National Party just has no tolerance for any sort of deviation on this issue? So I think it takes a brave Republican to say, and I think you kind of have to be either all in or all out. So you could say, I'm going to be a socially liberal Republican and fiscally conservative. In other words, I'm basically going to be a libertarian. So I'm going to be pro-choice and pro-marijuana legalization. But I think if you do one of the two, then you've got like zero base. And so we don't see many politicians like that.
What about Peggy Bacciocci from, is it Connecticut?
We see a few, but I think I'm saying we don't see very many. Gary Johnson is sort of running on a platform of being pro-choice and pro-marijuana legalization, probably in the 2012 presidential election. There are a few others, but it's a small set.
Okay. Getting back to numbers again. I know you're familiar with John Gettman because you cite his report in your 2010 paper. The biggest difference between the two of you, and I know that you have mutual respect for each other. Is that a fair statement?
That's a fair statement.
Okay. He comes up with about $110 billion in sales where you're at $11 billion. Okay. You both respect each other. You both worked really hard. How is that such a huge difference between you?
Well, there's sort of a couple sources of the difference. First, I'm using a demand-side estimate. There's data from surveys on the amount that people use. And he's using both such data and data from the supply side, estimates of the amount seized combined with some assumptions about what fraction of the market gets seized in a typical year, and those numbers turn out to be higher, okay, I think that the supply side numbers are very, very suspect because they come from law enforcement, and law enforcement has a strong incentive to want to make it look as though they're being very effective. They like to get show up on the nightly news saying, we seized $100 billion worth of marijuana, or we seized, you know, 1 million pounds of marijuana or something like that. When in fact, nobody got out of scale. Nobody has any idea what the weight or the value of all the seizures is. Frequently, when they estimate the weight, they're looking at the entire plant, not just at the smokable part. So the plant is way big compared to the smoke in terms of weight. They're looking at the wet weight, not the dry weight, which is more relevant for estimating the size of the market. So I basically don't use the supply side stuff, and I think one should be very, very cautious on the supply side stuff. When you use the demand side stuff, you get to a point where you have data on something like the number of daily users, the number of people who say to the surveys, I'm a daily user of marijuana. And then you have to come up with an idea about how much daily use means. Does it mean smoking puff a day, a joint a day, 5 joints a day? I mean, you have to make an assumption because we don't have that data from those users. And again, if I look at the assumptions that they've made, my guess is that many of the people who say they're daily users are consuming way less than the amount that they assume is being consumed on average. Mm-hmm. So again, the demand side estimates are higher than seems plausible to me.
Is there no way to factor in the incredible proliferation of dispensaries in areas where they've been allowed to go legal, like my own area here in South Denver, which is mind-blowing to me? I mean, I just coincidentally moved here. There's 20 dispensaries I can walk to in 12 minutes. I mean, my mind is blown. And then when I go visit, I see my brother in L.A., it's the same thing. It just seems to me like you're completely ignoring this. What am I missing?
I mean, it's certainly reasonable to try to get data from the dispensaries. I'm not aware that any of them has yet been willing to supply data on their sales or on the pound that they...
Let me give you a quick one. I went into a dispensary yesterday. I said, according to your business plan, if things go fairly well, how much tax will you be paying during this year? And that one dispensary said $150,000, just okay. Them. And you know how many dispensaries there are. I also didn't see you account for license fees. There seems to be like a lot of different rocks to turn over. And since you started doing your reports, I mean, if there was not that ONDCP table, would you have ever written a report?
There had not been that ONDCP table, I probably would have tried to do something similar myself. And so I could have basically done the report for ONDC was done by a consulting firm called Apt Associates. So I could have tried to do the Apt analysis on my own. Secondly, I might have then been somewhat more tempted to take the supply side estimates, but I would have discounted the magnitudes far more by making adjustments for the degree of how much I think they're likely overstated for sort of wet versus dry and things like that. In terms of the dispensaries, you need to know how much of what they're selling is actually going out of state. So it'd be very easy to say, okay, there are dispensaries in Colorado. Lights just went out of my office for reasons I don't understand. Is the picture still okay?
We still see you good. It just changed your background color. It's very flattering.
Okay, I guess that's fine. So you could get a highly exaggerated estimate if, in fact, people from other states are coming and purchasing from dispensaries in one state that has them and is adjacent to other states that don't.
You can't do that. You have to have a license for the state that you're in. You can't use your license.
Why can't someone from out of state go get a physician to write a script?
Well, they can. But if you don't already have that, I can't just go to another state and walk into a dispensary right now.
But it seems pretty easy to go to a doctor, walk across the border from a neighboring state to a doctor, get this prescription. I mean, they're not going to check that the address you give them is a correct address. So there's that kind of thing. But I'm perfectly willing to look at the dispensary data, but I don't think we yet have – one, it would be useful to have a few years' worth of data. But second, I don't think that the dispensaries have made it available yet. And partly, the issue raised, we don't have taxes being imposed, so it's not sort of systematic in terms of –
Here they are. I'm not sure about all the other states, but locally here they have to pay taxes.
Is it a city tax or a state tax?
They pay a city tax and a state tax, and I think Jeez. And then they have to pay a lot of licensing fees, $5,000, just to get their dispensary licenses going. So I didn't see that and then how about all the tax revenue from people just applying for medical marijuana cards? That's not in your report.
No, that's not in the report. I agree. Okay. But
what about import-export tax?
If we look at all the tax revenue you can collect.
Please do.
From any commodity, we do see that there are limits. So saying we can add more and more different kinds of taxes, that directly goes to this concern that we're going to drive the market back underground if we make it sufficiently highly taxed. I mean, one thing to note is I get criticized from both ends in the way I've done it. When I say, oh, we're going to have this legalized industry and we can collect taxes, bunches of people look at that and say, oh, no, everybody who's currently producing illegal is just going to stay underground, in which case there's no tax revenue. So I think the right answer is in between. As long as the taxation is moderate, it's going to come mainly above ground. Of course, there's still going to be some individuals who grow in their basement or their backyards or whatever, but I suspect a large fraction of it will come above ground. But just saying we can impose all these different kinds of taxes does start to beg the question of how much can you tax it before you drive it underground again.
Have you seen a lot of kind of naturally occurring job creation with all the dispensaries and all the different aspects of the dispensary craze? I don't know how big it is in Massachusetts.
It's not job creation. What it is job shifting. It's people who are doing other jobs who are then going to work in a legalized job, so then their job gets counted. So if somebody who has been growing marijuana in his backyard and spending a lot of time doing that or plotting a national park, whatever, now knows it's legal, so he decides he's going to be legal and he's going to officially sell it to some marijuana dispensary or some legalized outlet, then he will now legally report himself on his tax forms and to the surveys from the Bureau of Labor Statistics that he's employed as a marijuana farmer, whereas he didn't do that before. But that's not changing whether he's employed. That's just changing whether he's officially employed.
Do you think legalized marijuana would make farming sexy again?
Not for very long. I think it'll just become like a boring agricultural thing, just like everything else. If it's really legalized and treated like everything else, there shouldn't be any sexier than anything else. I mean, after all, it's basically a weed, so it's not that sexy to grow a weed.
Okay. Do you think there's any job? Do you think an economist is the only person that would be the best person to predict possible taxation revenue, or would a futurist also help?
I guess I would put most of my weight on economists. I'm not sure what a futurist is, but why and what a futurist would add to the discussion, other than I guess envisioning that somehow we'd have a totally different society with much, much more marijuana use if marijuana were legal.
Well, yeah, you would envision that. I can't
prove that's not going to happen, but I'm dubious.
Okay, now getting back to your reports, is there sort of an unwritten code that you have to depend on literature that came before you, and you're not really allowed to futurize about anything? And is there some sort of guide or code that, like the Hippocratic Oath for economists, when you undertake a report like your first marijuana reports for the state of Massachusetts? What is your limitation? How are you confined or constrained, or aren't you?
You're not constrained by to not do new things. What you're constrained by is, if you want to still be an economist, is to use the methodology that economists accept, meaning that in terms of thinking about how big the marijuana market would be, we look at the degree to which changes in price affect the amount consumed. We try to use evidence on how much the price is likely to go down based on evidence from comparing different places with different marijuana regimes. And so our forecast of what the marijuana market would be is based on that, not on some hypothesis that if it were legal, there might be five times as many users. Our hypothesis is, our view is, our framework is, the change in the amount consumed, the change in number of users would be governed by the change in the price, okay? And that seems to imply, based on the kinds of data that we've looked at for other products, relatively moderate changes, not drastic changes.
Haven't the data you looked at that's been looked at, isn't it mostly slanted towards just, as you said, weeds as opposed to edibles and cannabinoids and all the other potential products that could be made and all the hemp that could be grown and things like that? I don't see that any consideration for anything but straight weed. Don't you think that?
I don't see that. The estimates of the size of the market and what the elasticities are take into account evidence, some of it based on looking on people's use of marijuana. So that presumably did take into account the fact that there are multiple uses of marijuana, therapeutic versus recreational, for example. I think the hemp thing is probably a very, very small issue, because in every country that has allowed legalized hemp, okay, used for rope, for clothing, things like that, the hemp industry has been highly subsidized. It hasn't been the case that in places that were going to allow it, anyone actually really found it profitable to grow and use hemp to compete with nylon or cotton or whatever. So it may be they're going to turn out to be legal uses of hemp, but again, the existing evidence doesn't suggest that that's going to be a big deal that's going to generate a fundamental change in the economy.
If you work for a state board of equalization, let's say the South Dakota State Board of Equalization, how would you go about calculating what your state could collect in taxes from legalized marijuana?
I would do it based. First of all, I wouldn't work for a state board of equalization because I wouldn't work for the government. Second of all, if I were forced to work for the state board of equalization, I would use the methodology that I've used. I would make the people with the looking at the data aware that there were other estimates out there. I would provide the critiques or the cautions that I've suggested in our discussion, and tell them that there was, maybe the possibility that my numbers could be 50% too low or 100% too low. But I would say that my best judgment was that my estimates were the right order of magnitude, even if they weren't, they turned out to be somewhat too low. So I don't think I would do it any differently if I were talking working for a board of equalization.
Or a city.
I'm not sure why it should be different. The economic methodology is the economic methodology. It may be wrong, but that's what economists do. That's what we've utilized consistently. And I think the evidence is that for things like this, we're sort of pretty good about getting orders of magnitude. I mean, certainly not, going to swear that it's going to be 11 billion instead of 10 versus 13, but in terms of whether it's going to be somewhere between 10 and 20 as opposed to 80 to 100, I think the methodology has a reasonably good track record.
Okay, what about the big pharma industry and cannabinoids? Like, you're probably aware that they've conducted over 18,000 studies. Do you think that's a ripe area for taxation if it was nationally legalized and the pharmaceutical industry could train their guns on coming up with products, therapeutic products?
They may well develop therapeutic products, and they may well end up having significant sales of those. But those are going to be a few products out of an enormous pharmacopoeia. And any activity that goes into that is coming from some other activity that was generating tax revenue and economic activity. So we have to be careful about double counting for that aspect as with the other aspect that we discussed.
Could you foresee an Uncle Sam brand?
Well, I don't know. Are they going to get sued if they try to call it an Uncle Sam brand?
It would look nice on like a coffee can, Uncle Sam's face.
Might be. I'm sure there will be all sorts of entertaining labels out there if they're legally allowed, if a legalized industry is allowed to do that.
Because the government does compete with private sectors, like in treasury bills, for example, savings bonds. There's quite a few examples of the government competing with private sector that it taxes.
So why should the government? There's no earthly reason for the government to be in the business of producing and selling marijuana. It can just tax it if it wants the revenue. It doesn't gain anything by being in the actual business itself.
Then they get more than the taxes. They get all the profits, too.
No, they just tax away the profits. You don't need to be in the business to get the profits. You tax the profits.
Okay.
So, this is a mechanical thing. Just like with gambling. States don't need to be in the lottery business. They could just tax private lotteries and collect the same amount of revenue. How much you can collect from it doesn't depend on whether you're the supplier yourself or whether you're taxing someone else as a supplier.
Okay.
You set too high a price as the monopoly supplier, no one's going to end up buying it. You, in effect, drive the market underground. Okay? If someone else is doing it and you post too high a tax rate on them, you drive the market underground. But the profit is the same, either should be the same either way, and you can therefore capture whatever fraction of that you choose to capture.
Okay, let's talk. Is it okay to talk about some of the other reports that have come out? Do you mind?
Sure.
If Max Chazen, the Brown undergraduate who wrote The Other Green Academy, was in your class, what grade would you give him on his undergraduate thesis? Oh, and I should say, I should tell everyone that his thesis predicted at least $71 billion, probably $200 billion, and he wouldn't be surprised if there was $300 billion. So just that's the background. So,
if he'd been in my class, I would have been discussing his progress with him all along the way, and I would have cautioned him that I thought that the higher numbers he was coming up with were incredibly implausible and asked him to do more sort of robustness checks and more investigation into the supply side numbers that underlie his big estimates. And I would challenge him to go back and find the original sources of these amounts seized and these estimates that come from various sources that he uses. And I'm pretty sure what he'd find out is that there were never any data underlying some assertions about the size of the market. It was just some DEA or other official saying, I think the market would be this big, okay, based on nothing. And therefore, I would tell him, you know, you should put relatively little weight on that. So I guess I don't want to say what grade I would give him because it would have been a different experience.
So you don't find any merit in it whatsoever? Is there anything in there that was interesting to you or any kind of theory?
I don't think there's a lot of different theory. What's in there is a lot of data, a lot of work. I mean, there's a lot of merit in this thesis, but I think he didn't have...
Tell us some of the merit.
I don't think there's a lot of merit in the numbers. He didn't get instilled in him a healthy enough skepticism of data. I mean, any source of piece of data that one hears from about anything, even less controversial things, it's useful to ask, well, how did someone actually figure out that number? How could anyone actually know that number? And, you know, there's an example related to the book Freakonomics, in which it makes a claim that the wages of architects are higher or lower than the wages of prostitutes or something like that. So an economist went out to try to check that. Economist named John DiNardo at University of Michigan. And he basically found that he couldn't get any data anywhere on the wages of architects or the wages of prostitutes. So how could anyone know which was higher or lower if there were no decent data on either of the two pieces? So the skepticism about data, that's what was missing from Max's thesis.
He found quite a few metric tons, and I only found his report a couple of days ago, and then I was trying to reread it and find out where he found the metric tons from. But that was a little obscure, but I haven't given up yet.
I've looked at some of those things, and what you see is that one report cites an earlier report, and an earlier report cites a still earlier report. And it's sooner or later you sort of lose it and can't find out, or you can't even find the initial reports that had these numbers. And so you actually don't have any idea where the original estimates came from. So I don't know whether to put any weight on those whatsoever.
Okay. Now, John Getman, I guess I'm still a little unclear that he really seemed like he turned over a lot of rocks to try to find different ways to calculate. I mean, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but once again, do you not see any of them being meritorious? Because he gives quite a lot of criticism of your dependence on the 2000 ONDCP report, as does Chaykin. You just talked about Chaykin. What about Getman? Was there anything in his methodology that you would agree with, or you discount it because you have not reacted to his figures?
I think his figures are too high. We've basically discussed those. He uses both demand side and supply side. The demand side pretty consistently come out to be lower than the supply side. So he takes an average. So that's why he gets a number that's sort of in between my estimates and Chaykin's estimates. So Chaykin is kind of the extreme supply side, putting almost all the weight on supply side. Getman is putting weight on an average of the two approaches, and I'm using sort of only the demand side, which tend to be the lowest. So that's why the three end up being in that ordered in the way that they're ordered. So again, I wouldn't use the supply side at all, but that's part of why I end up with a lower number. On the demand side, I think that the amount assumed per use, okay, for each person who shows up in the demand side estimates, okay, is probably too big. Okay, and so that's the difference between mine and Getman's on the focusing only on the demand side. And then there's some more sort of detailed, sort of wonky things that I don't, you know, remember all the details of, but basically that's the crucial number. And if you look at the California Board of Equalization estimates, okay, it comes down to the same thing. They're basically using a demand side approach. They have data on frequency of use broken down by, you know, daily users and annual users and so on, and they focus on the people who are regular users, and they have an assumption, okay, about how much is being consumed per daily user. Okay? But we don't know what a daily user is. Is a daily user someone who has a puff or two before going to sleep each night, who consumes all day, you know, every day, and that's what daily use means? Okay, so at a minimum, without knowing whether daily users are mainly in one category or mainly in the other category, you can clearly get a really big range. But they in particular assume an amount that seems sort of unlikely to be the case.
So would it be fair to say that you are loath to ever assume anything, so you just go with whatever facts that there are?
Well, I still have to assume a lot in my analysis. I have to make an assumption about what the demand elasticity is. So I looked at what elasticities are like for legal goods that have somewhat similar properties, tobacco, alcohol.
Define elasticity in a sentence or two.
Sorry, elasticity is how much the quantity demanded responds to changes in the price. Okay, so if, what we find is that for most commodities, when the price goes up, the quantity consumed purchase goes down. In this case, we're talking about a decline in the price from legalization. Exactly how big a decline, we don't know for sure, but again, we have some sort of information. Okay. In some ways, I've actually assumed things that would make my tax revenue estimate sort of even smaller, because depending on what that elasticity is, you know, we may get different numbers than I came up with. So I have to make assumptions too, lots of assumptions, but I try to minimize them. And I certainly tried to err, if I was erring, on the cautious side. But I didn't make that kind of choice where I thought I was erring by a factor of 10 to 1. I made that choice where I thought maybe I was erring by a factor of 10 or 20%. Take the take underreporting of use, okay, by people who respond to surveys. One can easily imagine that when you pick up the phone and someone on the other end says, "I'm from the federal government, I would like to ask you how often you use marijuana," yeah, some people might say never, when in fact the truth is that they do. Okay, now, few people might actually lie in the other direction and claim they use it when they don't. Who knows? But it's perfectly plausible that use is underreported in these surveys. Mm-hmm. But we have a lot of studies that have compared survey measures of use to objective measures of use and have found that the surveys are low by 10 or 20%, not by 50 or 80 or 90%. Okay, so sometimes you can ask people whether they use drugs, but you've also given them your analysis test. So you can check whether they, in fact, have used drugs and compare it against. And the degree of honesty is actually sort of surprising. It's not 100%, but it's not sort of dramatically less than 100% either. So I don't think that major adjustments – I do not make an adjustment for that. If you said that the ONDCP numbers on reported use rates were low by 10%, that would imply a 10% bigger number. But that's, 11 billion instead of 11 point, instead of 12 billion. It's not a radical change.
Okay.
It's not getting you to 100 billion or 300 billion.
Okay. Now, are you allowed to put any kind of creativity in your reports? Because it almost seemed like you were trying to not go into potential revenue streams that don't already exist. For example, Scott Bates, that I know you're familiar with, that wrote about the economic implications for Alaska, he talks about the state coming up with Alaska energy bars, which are edibles. He talks about cannabis tourism. Do you not feel any obligation to your audience to look for creative ways?
It's nothing to do with creativity. It has to do with accuracy. So let's take a related example. Tons and tons of states and cities decide to build versus subsidize baseball stadiums, football stadiums, convention centers, and so on and so forth. Okay? They always commission some local consulting firm to do an economic impact statement. Okay? And lo and behold, because those studies were commissioned by the group that wanted to actually get the stadium built, they always end up finding that there's some unbelievable benefit from building a new baseball stadium in Boston. Right?
Okay.
First of all, and now in the case of a state, there is an argument as to why there might be some significant economic benefit, which is maybe if Boston has a much better Fenway Park than the current Fenway Park, that's 50,000 seats instead of 35,000 seats, we'll get more customers, okay, from Rhode Island, from New Hampshire, maybe an occasional Yankees fan, New York. So there will be money coming into Massachusetts from out of state, spent on the tickets, on the hotels, on the meals, et cetera. Okay. Now, it turns out also that zillions of economists have evaluated the before and after for state revenues and economic activity of adding convention centers and stadiums and things like that. They universally find that there's almost no net benefit and frequently a big net loss.
Okay.
Why? Because, first of all, almost everyone who goes to Fenway Park is already Massachusetts residents. Okay? Second of all, there's tons of double counting. When Massachusetts, if it gets more people to come and go to baseball games, most of that is because those people weren't going to a football game or weren't going to some other to a movie or weren't going to some other to NASCAR or something else. So it's just a shift in their dollars. For the country as a whole, if Alaska has cannabis tourism, that's just money on tourism that's not being spent on some other kind of tourism, which almost for the most part was going to be within the United States. So there's no net benefit. It's just shifting what dollars are spent on.
You mentioned convention centers. There's a huge cannabis convention in our Denver convention center this weekend. That's going to generate some bucks.
Okay, so it may generate.
Is that the same theory? It's just money that would have gone somewhere else?
Yes.
Or is that money that's really taxable? Is that really money going into government or not? How can you say no?
For Denver, it may be a net plus. But if we legalize, first of all, if we legalize for the whole country, the number of cannabis conventions is going to go down. There's no particular reason anymore to have cannabis conventions. And secondly, even if there are, that's going to be robbing one state to pay another state. Okay, it's fine. There's conventions for legal goods. I think the attractiveness of the cannabis conventions is going to go down once it's a legalized product. But even if it doesn't, that's just money that's not being spent on computer conventions, on Star Trek conventions, on things like that. It's not a net gain. We can't double count. So it's nothing to do with creativity. It has to do with accuracy.
Okay. Well, you've been a great sport, Jeff. We super appreciated you. And because you've been such a great sport about answering all my questions, I also know that you're an activist about complete legalization. If there's anything you would like to say to our audience, please feel free to just any message you have for people out there. And once again, we super appreciate you being such a good sport about handling our grilling here at Cannabis Conversation.
I would say what I sort of hinted at earlier is I think we have a better chance of convincing the country to change policy and staying that way over the long haul if we focus on the arguments other than the budgetary taxation arguments. They certainly don't need to admit the budgetary taxation arguments, but I think they're item number 6, 7, or 8 on the list of reasons. The crucial reasons are the enhanced welfare of current marijuana users. The second reason is the enhanced welfare of people who would like to use marijuana but are abstaining because they're worried about the legal penalties. The third crucial benefit is reduced crime. Fourth is reduced corruption. Fifth is improvements in civil liberties because people are not being harassed to enforce the marijuana laws based on the color of their skin or have to worry about having their door knocked down in the middle of the night and things like that. And so the fact that we will spend less money on police and prosecutors is certainly a plus. The fact that we'll collect some tax revenues is certainly a plus. But to me, these other arguments that I just mentioned are even more important, and those are the ones that we should focus on in arguing for legalized marijuana. So that's my message.
Thank you. And if those arguments continue to fall on deaf ears in Washington, could you ever envision a marijuana march on Washington?
Sure. Absolutely in favor of that, in which I hope every single participant would abstain to make the point that this is about changing the law and freedom. It's not just about being a marijuana user, because everybody would benefit from the change in policy, not just people who have an interest in consuming marijuana.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time. We super appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Have a great day. And is it okay to put your reports on our server on our website so people can read them?
The ones, not the most recent one. The one that's 2010 that's forthcoming from Cato, they're going to release later this summer. But all the precursors are perfectly fine.
Okay, thank you again. Take care.
Thanks. Take care.
Bye now.
All right. Okay.